It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
In which the theme of the day is supply chain, but not the way you think. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, today the 22nd of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, among the many ways the pandemic changed this economy, and to be clear, it is still changing, but one of the big ones that became pretty clear pretty early on was that our supply and manufacturing chains were pretty vulnerable, being as offshore as they were, and that was not good, people decided. Over the past couple of years, reshoring has been a business buzzword of choice, so much so that according to a new report from the Reshoring Initiative, a lobbying group that's been tracking this stuff since 2010, they say American companies are on pace to reshore nearly 350,000 jobs this year. That's up from 250,000 last year. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab gets us going.
Let's talk global manufacturing and logistics and all the hiccups they've seen recently. There's the pandemic, which has repeatedly shut down factories in China. Fires and flooding have done the same in Japan and Thailand. There was that ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal, and add in skyrocketing shipping costs. John Gray is a professor of operations at The Ohio State University.
This memory is going to be sticky of all of these challenges that companies have faced, and they're going to, wherever possible, I think, try to shorten the supply chain.
A shorter chain means less room for error and uncertainty, but that security comes with a higher price tag, so it's not worth it for every company.
Products that are high labor content, relatively easy to ship, not a major national security or intellectual property risk, those probably will likely remain in low-cost countries for some time.
The U.S. is not going to become a leader in manufacturing apparel or toys, but it's gaining some jobs in high-tech manufacturing for things like semiconductors and electric vehicle batteries. David Simchi-Levi is a data scientist at MIT. He says tensions between the U.S. and China and legislation like the CHIPS and Science Act and the Inflation Reduction Act will incentivize manufacturing in the U.S.
Companies are now willing to take the investment. I think this is here to stay.
So what does this mean for American workers? The 350,000 added jobs may not sound like much, but Susan Hausman, an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, says it's equal to 3% of U.S. manufacturing.
So if this translates into a net increase in employment, that's not a small thing.
And what really makes it not a small thing is that these are considered good middle-class jobs for people who don't necessarily have an advanced degree. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Okay, moving from one end of the supply chain to the other, we've decided to call up some of our retail regulars to get a snapshot or three of how things are going in the small business world. Eric Vaughn makes custom frames in Detroit.
It's been so busy that we had to move to doing appointments only. Our supply chain has been really difficult. The suppliers, they don't have particular items that we need to make the frames. I had a job for a quilt, and the quilt was really huge, and it was going into a hospital. We were going to frame it, and we couldn't find any plexiglass big enough discussed it with the artist, and the artist decided she would cut the quilt down and, you know, without compromising the integrity of the quilt. And we were able to, you know, acquire a plexiglass in this area. Well, the next 5 to 6 months, I'd like to see another employee or two, because that would help out the stress level on me and my assistant.
That was Eric Vaughn. He's making custom frames at Eric's I've Been Framed. He's in Detroit. More small business retailers coming up a little later on in the program today. Economic eyes are firmly focused later on in the week. Jay Powell gives a big, big speech on Friday. Spoiler alert, he's going to say the Fed's going to keep raising interest rates and that how much they're going to raise depends on what the data says. You can take that to the central bank. Thought of that one all by myself. Also this week, Friday too, as it happens, the Fed's favorite measure of inflation, personal consumption expenditures. Thursday gets us a second look at second quarter gross domestic product. I am telling you, it's going to be a busy week. Wall Street today was kind of busy. Lots of nerves, a little bit of fear and loathing, maybe. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Right after Russia invaded Ukraine back in late February, it's going to be 6 months on Wednesday, by the way. But back then, Lily Jamali did a story for us about remittances, Ukrainian expats scrambling to send money back home. It was chaotic, to be charitable. Service was limited. Transfers were capped, and it took days, if not weeks, sometimes to get the money there while the humanitarian crisis, as we all know, was exploding. So here is Lily with a follow-up.
I met Yulia Lopateva less than a week into the war on the main drag of San Francisco's Ukrainian enclave, Geary Street. She was distraught, worrying about family and friends scattered across her homeland.
In Zaporozhye, in Kiev, Chernigov.
She sent $100 to her twin brother by MoneyGram. It took 3 days to reach him. And she couldn't use her Ukrainian bank at all, she told me at the time.
It doesn't work. I can't do any payments. I can't send money.
Her brother died of a stroke a few days later. After their initial trouble, Yulia and her daughter Paulina scoured the internet for alternatives. Recently, Paulina told me they stumbled across a service called Wise.
I just Googled and I saw the website is pretty much secured. So there's like two-factor verification. You can connect it to your bank.
She says Wise ended up being faster and cheaper than the remittance services and banks they'd long relied on.
So right now, the transfer to Ukraine got actually easier.
Remittances spiked as the invasion got underway. In May, the World Bank estimated they would rise more than 20% this year. But Susan Pozo of Western Michigan University says so far she's not seeing that in data from the National Bank of Ukraine. It shows remittances for the first half of this year at $6.5 billion. For the same period last year, it was nearly $7 billion.
So you don't see a substantial increase. You see, in fact, a little decrease.
Pozo says the war has been driving people in and out of Ukraine, and that's changed the flow of money in and out of the country.
You have a lot of family separations. You know, the men have to stay, but the women and the children have left. You have 6 million refugees.
That means some remittances that would have gone to Ukrainians in Ukraine are probably now going elsewhere, says Danny Bahar of Brown University.
They're going to family members who have settled in Poland and Moldova, for instance. So those are numbers that officially they're not remittances to Ukraine anymore. They're now remittances to Poland or Moldova, but they are going to people who a few months ago they were living in Ukraine.
Major players in the remittance industry have responded to all the turmoil, says Ina Ganguly of the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
During the war, it seems like a lot of these companies have made these changes to make it easier.
Western Union, for one, is now allowing remittances sent to Ukraine to be picked up in neighboring countries for the first time. And Ganguly says Ukrainians seem to be paying more attention to the cost of remittances.
And what you see is it's really expensive. And Ukraine actually has like some of the highest fees associated with it.
Between the high costs and the fact that some services were suspended, delayed, or capped early in the war, Caroline Theoharidis at Amherst College says she's not surprised that some Ukrainians abroad found alternatives.
There's a market there, but the market wasn't working very well.
And Ukrainians like Yulia and Paulina Lapativa aren't sure they'll go back to sending money to those who need it the way they used to. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Another week, another visit to Taiwan by a group of American government officials. This delegation led by Eric Holcomb, the Republican governor of Indiana. He is traveling, the governor is, with Hoosier colleagues looking to expand economic and academic ties by, in particular, bringing semiconductor production by Taiwanese companies to Indiana. We do not, I imagine, by this point in the news cycle, need to review the visit to Taiwan by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the Chinese response to the visit to Taiwan by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and the Biden administration's announcement that it's going to launch official trade talks with Taiwan in the fall. It is politically complicated. It is also, even with the size imbalance between Taipei and Beijing, a big deal economic story. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to explain what's at stake here.
The U.S. wants to stop China from taking over the island by force and threatening U.S. allies like Japan and South Korea. But reducing trade barriers and expanding business ties has its own economic logic, says Mary Lovely at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Trade is an integral part of why Taiwan is important to the U.S. The island has been able to produce very important products and has become an integral part of U.S. supply chains.
Taiwan is the U.S.'s eighth largest trading partner, and it exports crucial advanced computer chips, says Ishwar Prasad at Cornell University.
It's a market for certain U.S. exports, such as agricultural products, but also consumer goods that actually come through China do have technology from Taiwan. Taiwan also exports directly to the U.S.
So why unsettle all these crucial supply chains with official visits and trade talks that raise China's hackles? Prasad says the U.S. is trying to assert regional economic leadership.
It's one way of, you know, poking China in the eye.
Also, U.S. officials, like the delegation from Indiana, want Taiwanese companies to build more factories to produce their fancy computer chips here in the U.S. Finally, former U.S. ambassador to APEC, Kurt Tong, says U.S.-Taiwan trade talks are likely to be less provocative to China than political or military moves.
Having the Taiwan economy closely linked to the rest of the global economy is not really a threat to China's ultimate hope of reunification.
He says China itself depends heavily on trade with Taiwan and wants the island's economy to keep thriving. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We're going to steal a line from last week's report on July retail sales to set up this next stop on our retailer review. In the category sporting goods, hobby, book, and music stores, total sales barely budged month to month, but year over year up 1.6%. It is, to be fair, a very broad category, that one, so an individual business's mileage may vary. Here's Diane Jenks. She's a bike fitter at her husband's shop. It's called Hubbub Bicycles in Kirtland, Ohio.
Business is dicey, I would say, is the best way to put it. Some days you're the pigeon and some days you're the statue. If parts are available, business is good. If you're being told parts are 6 months to a year out, Business can be very scary right now. One of the biggest cost increases is freight. And our clients are fairly affluent. When you tell them we're going to have to pass this freight charge on, they just go, I get it. I think they're disappointed more about the delay than they are about pricing. I think a lot of people are afraid that a lot of these really nice independent shops are going to go away. And they are going away. And I don't want to be one of the, I don't want ours to be one of those shops.
Diane Jenks there, fitting bikes at Hubbub Bicycles in Kirtland, Ohio. Coming up,
we actually start making bows in July.
Oh, holiday season is just around the corner. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's today. Dow Industrial's down 643, 1.9%, closed at 33,063. The NASDAQ down 323 points, 2.5%, 12,381. The S&P 500 down 90 points. That's 0.2%, 41.37. The healthcare at home company, Signify Health, appears to be a subject of interest from Amazon and United Health and CVS. All are reportedly considering making a bid to snap up Signify, which soared 32% today. Not looking real good for Bed Bath & Beyond. The retailer slipped 16% today. On Friday, shares down 40%, 40, after news that a big investor sold all his shares. Bloomberg reported last week that some suppliers are restricting or halting shipments to BB&B. It's the peril of becoming a meme stock. Peeps, you're listening to Market Minutes.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hey, so how are you feeling about your job? If you're of a certain age, by which I mean not what you think I mean, but rather somebody who is new-ish to the labor force, chances are you've got mixed emotions. Work's fine and all, the job's good, but there is more to life than 9 to 5, you know. That phenomenon has a name. It's called quiet quitting. And Lindsay Ellis wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal the other day. Lindsay, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
The first thing we need to say about quiet quitting is that it's not really quitting, right?
Exactly. I mean, what I hear from workers is that it's just this sense of, I want to do my job, but not go above and beyond and have work bleed into my personal life the way maybe it had been for the last couple of years. So I think this sense of quiet quitting in some ways is a misnomer, and in some ways just speaks to the boundaries that a lot of these young employees want to set.
What's your sense of how long this has been a thing?
It's a great question. As I think back to just the interviews I've been doing, this sense of disillusionment, the sense of I want to untether my job from my identity, that's been a theme that's been pretty constant over the last, you know, maybe year or so. And so while I think the term quiet quitting appears to have really picked up steam since mid-July or so, I think this sense of really wanting to step up boundaries, that sense has been pretty constant among workers over this last stretch.
Yeah. What are companies and employers saying about this? Because you could see them being a little bit, what do you mean? I'm paying you and you got to do the job.
Yeah. Well, you know, Gallup has been doing a lot of polling over the years on employee engagement, and across the country, U.S. engagement is falling in the workforce. I mean, I think that's a trend that is concerning for employers, because there's some correlation between how engaged you are at your job and how long you want to stay there, you know, how willing you might be to recommend it to a friend as a workplace, you know, things like that, maybe even productivity, which obviously workplaces care a lot about, all of those things. So I think there's a degree of hesitation. I mean, maybe frustration with this downturn in engagement that is happening a lot more broadly than the youngest of professionals.
How much do you think this would be happening if the unemployment rate wasn't where it is, right? I mean, this is a very employee-favored environment now, and if you want another job, you can get another job, and everybody on both sides of the equation knows that.
It's a really good point. I mean, so I talked to Elise Friedman, who's a senior client partner at the consulting firm Korn Ferry, about this very issue. I mean, and she, you know, said the people who are consciously dialing back, who might not be raising their hand for the stretch assignments or the extra work at the end of the day, I mean, that they might be setting themselves up for a layoff if things do turn. So I think there is some realization that this is perhaps a byproduct of the leverage that employees have in the labor market right now, and that there could well be a risk if things do turn.
All right. So on the theory that higher-ups at the Wall Street Journal aren't listening, what's your engagement level?
I was joking actually with a colleague that, you know, the hours worked on the quiet quitting story would make a lot of Gen Z employees make fun of me, I think, behind my back. But no, I think it is sort of striking how openly folks are talking about the changes they're making to their own work patterns.
Lindsay Ellis, she covers careers at the Wall Street Journal. She's very engaged, by the way, if you're listening and you're a Wall Street Journal boss. She's very engaged. Lindsay,
thanks, Kai, for that.
I try to help people out. Lindsay, thanks a lot.
All right, take care.
My minivan, according to the speedometer, can hit a top speed of 110 miles an hour. Not that I've tried or even come close, but apparently I could if I wanted to. But should I have the option? New York City has put high-tech speed governors on some of its city-owned vehicles, devices that govern how fast those vehicles can go, the local speed limit, one assumes. It's part of a growing movement to put speed limiters on new cars, a movement that we should say the auto industry ain't none too thrilled with. Marketplace's Matt Levin has this one.
American pop culture does not respect speed limits.
On green, I'm going for it.
There's a reason that movie is called The Fast and the Furious and not The Slow and the Circumspect. Equating speeding with fun is part of the reason speed limiters aren't on every car already, says Leah Shaham with the transportation safety group Vision Zero Network.
The advertising of cars is just ingrained in our brain that this is some natural step of freedom.
Speed limiters have been around since the early 1900s, but Shaham says the idea is gaining momentum now because of a spike in traffic deaths during the pandemic. While the number of cars on the road declined,
what that seemed to do, though, is give people who were on the road this space, literally, to go a lot faster.
Speed limiting tech has gotten better, too. Systems now can use geolocation to change how fast a car can go in different places. But having only new cars on the road with that tech won't solve speeding overnight, says Thomas Hundle with the auto website The Autopian.
Let's say, drop of a hat, every vehicle, 2023 model year and later, needs a speed limiter. Okay, well, the average vehicle age in the United States is, I want to say, a shade over 13 years old.
Some speed limiter skeptics say mixing slower driving new cars with faster old ones could make traffic more dangerous. Last month, a new European rule went into effect mandating speed limiters on new cars. Although the limiters are pretty limited, drivers can override them easily. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Rounding out our retail regulars today, a dispatch here from Irene Kesselman. She runs Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina.
Our business right now is up and holding its own. Our inventory is, we're pretty full right now and selling and filling in as we receive holiday items. I am still dealing with products being late. We've ordered some beautiful wrapping paper and we are trying to get some ribbon to correspond with the paper. And we are having a time and a half trying to get ribbon shipped to us from different locations. And we are a little bit behind on making bows. We actually start making bows in July. So in that case, I don't feel prepared, but merchandise-wise, I do feel prepared.
Irene Kesselman, Alley Cat Toys is the business, Carrboro, North Carolina is the place. This final note on the way out today. Anybody remember MoviePass, the movie subscription service where you could pay like 10 or 15 bucks a month and go see as many movies as you wanted? And about which, once we all found out that the company was paying theaters full freight for each of those visits, we all said, how can that possibly work? And it turned out it couldn't. And MoviePass imploded in September of 2019. Remember that? Yeah, well, they're back. Axios reports today MoviePass is rebooting. Waitlist opens Thursday morning. Service starts in September. Actual details, yeah, still to come. All right, we're going. Your moment of economic context, though, comes first, and it comes out of Detroit, where Ford said this morning it's laying off 3,000 white-collar workers. CEO Jim Farley said in an earnings call last month that the company needs to trim down their internal combustion engine team as they go electric. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Guiong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.